Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, the television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Erin Vanderhoof, and I am an avid royal watcher here at Vanity Fair. And earlier this year, I was one of the co-hosts of our podcast, Dynasty, which looked at the lives of the British royal family. So today, I'm here to talk about a program which I am very excited about, Netflix's The Crown. All 10 episodes of its fifth season have just debuted, and joining me to talk about this is my Vanity Fair colleague and expert on both fictional and real-life royals, Julie Miller.
Hi, Erin. I'm so excited to talk about this new season, which picks back up with the royals at the beginning of the 90s, which I think even casual royal watchers will know that this was not a great decade for the family. And later in the episode, you'll hear our conversation with someone who knows the royals better than anyone, Vanity Fair's royals correspondent, Katie Nicholl.
Timing is everything. And, you know, we know that they suspended filming in respect of the Queen's death. But for this to be going out just weeks into King Charles III's reign is, you know, inconvenient, I suppose, is a bit of an understatement.
And we should let listeners know from the start that we're going to primarily talk about the first five episodes of the season, since they all just dropped and we can't expect you to simultaneously watch them. But we will mention some plot details from later in the season as well, so beware, there are a few spoilers ahead.
So let's get to Charles and Diana, which is the, you know, understandably the centerpiece of this season, especially for us American watchers. Like, This segment of time in those two people's lives is, like, why we care about the royals. So Dominic West has taken over as Charles, and Elizabeth Debicki is Diana, and we see Olivia Williams take over as Camilla. So, Julie, what do you think of the new cast?
Well, Elizabeth Debicki is such a standout for me. She's completely mesmerizing. She has that whole, she's always sort of looking down with her big eyes looking up. So she is just phenomenal to watch. Dominic West is interesting because when he was cast, I didn't know that I would buy him as Charles, just because Dominic is more, should we say, traditionally handsome. But the series, I thought he did a really, really remarkable job, and I sort of forgot about it, you know, a few minutes into the first episode. What did you think?
Well, I'm one of those crazy people that thinks Prince Charles is perfectly handsome. I will say that I think that Dominic is, like, a little less awkward than Charles. And so there's a sense that, you know, at least in thinking about him as Charles, that you sort of have the kind of person Charles kind of wishes he could be or wants to be. There's, like, a bit of bravado that he puts on. And I think that that works really well in this season, where it's all about just, it's all about, like, Charles trying to take control for the first time and, like, how poorly it goes very frequently.
Right. No, if I were Charles, I would love that casting.
Yeah. And then I think Olivia Williams as Camilla is just, she's really does just a great job of, because to play that role in the season, it's like a person who is losing control of her entire life and figuring out how she is going to deal with that. And, like, she just nails these sort of, like, looking out the window, eyes wide in surprise that everyone's there, or like, you know, head in their hand, like, what have I done?
Right. And yeah, we really see a sort of warmth to her, and you understand why, you know, Charles loves her, what she brings to the table. But I loved Emerald Fennell last season, but Olivia Williams just completely looks like Camilla so much with that, the fringe and everything. I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. The first five episodes cover a few major moments in Diana's life. In terms of fashion, the highlight probably here is the famous revenge dress, which I got to speak to the costume designer about recreating. She had some interesting things to say about Diana in general, just because last season we saw a lot of Diana out on these red carpets going to these glamorous events. And this time around, we see Diana sort of isolated. We see her a lot in her Kensington Palace apartment. When she's going out, it's almost like she's going out in disguise. So they sort of tapped into a spy thriller type feel in terms of dressing her. But episode two really dives into one of the most famous Diana moments of all. And I think this was really the breaking point for the royal family with her. It was her interview with Andrew Morton that became the book Diana, Her True Story. Of course, we know she secretly collaborated with him. And in this episode, we get to see sort of a TikTok of how that happened.
Well, I just loved the juxtaposition. So, you know, famously, she had an intermediary that she would record tapes. It was a doctor. And he, the doctor friend, would take the tapes to Andrew Morton. And so at no point in time had they ever, you know, they had never even met, I'm pretty sure. I love the way that the episode kind of juxtaposes like the sort of almost like slapsticky spy nature of the workaround that's going on here with just the absolute utter heartbreak of listening to Elizabeth Debicki say the things that Diana really said on that tape. Like, that, for all they play around with dialogue in this show, they stick really, really close to the things that Diana actually said. And that is, to me, that was just the most, I think that was the most heartbreaking moment I have ever seen on The Crown, because right, You so infrequently get to have this opportunity to hear, I mean, especially just like a young mother who feels isolated talking about the way she really feels about things.
How quickly did things start to go sour?
Well, I started to unravel at the honeymoon. And at night, I was having these dreadful nightmares about Camilla.
When the Queen was there, I always felt second place.
And Charles barely looked at me.
I just felt like a fish out of water.
And I was so thin.
My bones were just sticking out all over the place.
When I talked to him about photographers hounding me,
he talked about Camilla.
When I tried to be brave, make a speech in Welsh,
I got no support.
And I just felt like a lamb to the slaughter.
Did you feel that your husband was committed to the marriage in the same way that you were?
Well, there was always the other one.
So then later, Andrew Morton did really release those transcripts after her death,
which are incredible,
yeah, and
to read.
They're incredible. It was difficult for me to watch that episode as much as I also loved it. I cannot imagine that anybody who knew her well is going to be able to actually sit down and watch this episode, because it is heartbreaking.
Right. It bears noting Andrew Morton was an official consultant on the series, so this episode is pretty true to life, including the part that Diana, I guess, initially warmed to Andrew Morton because he had written a previous story that sort of irked Charles. So that was part of the reason why she warmed to him.
At certain points, this does kind of feel like Diana fan fiction a little
bit. Oh my
bit.
Gosh.
Like the scenes. But there are certain points where, like, definitely when Diana is, like, getting off zingers on Charles, it's just so funny.
So funny. But her, like, winding the phone cord around her arm while she sits on her bed, like, digging into her chocolate ice cream, it really was some sort of fanfic.
Yeah. So Diana does get to have her say with the Andrew Morton book when it comes out, though nobody knew it at the time. Everybody was wondering, how do they know this if she didn't participate? And the workaround was pretty good. But then later, Charles gets to have his say in the famous interview with Jonathan Dimbleby, which we see in episode 5. And with apologies to King Charles III, the current reigning monarch, I think we have to call it the Tampon Gate episode.
We sure do. And, you know, when you spoke to Katie Nichols, she was speaking a little bit about the show blurring fact and fiction. And this is an episode where it gets especially tricky because they recreate this conversation that Camilla and Charles had using a lot of the actual dialogue.
Oh, darling, I just want you now.
Do you? So do I.
Desperately. Desperately.
God, I wish I could just live inside your trousers or something. So much easier.
What are you going to turn into? A pair of knickers?
Well, God forbid, a Tampax. And just my luck.
Idiot. What a wonderful idea.
So if someone's just kind of clocking into that episode and they see, you know, these lines being recreated, they might imagine that the entire episode as it is was true to life. I spoke to Sally Bedell Smith, who is a royal biographer who wrote a book about Charles. And I was so interested because it shows Charles calling the Parker Bowles household and Camilla's husband picking up. She said that didn't really happen. But, you know, when the call was placed, Camilla was at home with the kids, which I found interesting. But I want to get your take on this. It was fascinating to see them construct this episode because they're recreating one of the most humiliating moments in Charles's life just as he finally becomes king. But then in the back half of the episode, it's like they try to sort of reverse damage control that by speaking about the prince's trust and all this incredible work he did.
When the title card comes up, it's like, the prince's trust has directed 1.4 billion pounds to. It's like,
right.
You're right, that if you, in its construction, it does kind of feel like, oh, okay, if we're going to do this to him, we got to at least like take him seriously or respect him. I love and like respect Prince Charles deeply right now, or King Charles III now, but I think it was realizing that there is a sense in which he is a pretty regular guy who's not always thinking about the consequences of his actions, who like does have this genuine passion to make the world better, but is like always stepping on rakes. He's lived his life in the sense that like the most embarrassing things he's ever done are like there on TV, and yet he still has like enough like self-regard that he gets up every day and goes on.
Right.
I think in the show they're saying like, oh, he was kind of like coaxed to, you know, talk about his adultery on TV. But like Dimbleby had been working on a biography for a lot longer, and the biography like goes into detail about adultery, about the breakdown of the marriage, about really personal things between him and Diana. So I think that it had been planned. But the first thing that he does after this TV show, Diana goes to it aired the night it airs. Diana goes to a Vanity Fair party at the Serpentine Gallery in the revenge dress. First thing he does is he goes to Los Angeles for a 1 week tour to, like, I guess the stated purpose is to see how the city's recovered from the LA riots. And he, but he also was there, like, has tea with Barbara Streisand and,
how could you
know,
not?
Yeah, goes to the party, like one of the only big parties that Aaron Spelling ever threw at Candyland, and went to a high school in Compton and saw, you know, kids who had started sort of like a lunch truck there. Went to a Vaughn's supermarket. Just like all of these crazy things. And it's just like so funny to me to like all of these pictures of like Charles like enjoying like the real LA while he's like, you know, set the world on fire in Britain. And I think so, which brings us to, you know, the end of this episode. I like, even if people don't like The Crown, I just like hope that they like watch the scene because it's so great. We're listening to Don't Sweat the Technique. He's with young black kids who are breakdancing, and Charles, Dominic West as Charles, just like starts dancing too, and it's really great. And what I love about it is that I have seen Charles so many times, like on the sidelines of a bunch of people dancing for him, being like nodding and like, yes, yes, proper and polite. And there's something so hilarious about just imagining him for once, just like getting to be that guy who is there because he belongs there and like is having fun.
Well, Aaron, you don't have to imagine because you can go on YouTube and search Prince Charles breakdancing, and there is actual video I learned last night of him in 1985. On a similar like disco dance floor in his classic double-breasted jacket. And I have to give it to him. He wasn't as smooth as Dominic West, but he really tried. You see him do the robot. You see him do all these sorts of moves. He gave it a good try. So I, you know, hats off to him.
That's amazing. See, once again, I'm glad that everybody else is getting to it. I have to watch that. Wow.
I know. It was quite the discovery. But it is interesting to know, I guess, some around this time of the tampon gate, Prince Charles put a sign on his dressing room saying, be patient and endure. So that's sort of perfect and poignant. I hope it's still there when this season premieres.
So that brings us to the central figure of the whole series, Queen Elizabeth II, now played by Imelda Staunton. But the first episode draws a not especially flattering parallel between the Queen and the royal yacht, which at this point in the 90s was incredibly old-fashioned and expensive. So, Julie, how did it feel to watch this when we've basically just finished mourning the Queen?
It was a little awkward for me, and there were moments where I could get lost in storylines, and there were moments where I was very aware of the timing of this new season coming out, and I think this episode was maybe especially to watch. There's a scene of Elizabeth making the case as to why the government should keep funding Britannia, and she has a line like, all of my other palaces were inherited, which might be the least sympathetic line ever uttered on the crown. But it just, you know, really the whole season was a little bit hard because it seems like her lowlight reel. These were her hardest hits, and there's something that just seems a little bit cruel about rewatching that. But at the same time, as an entertainment viewer, it makes for incredible drama.
So I think that to me, it was very helpful watching this only a month after. I've been thinking a lot about, and even just, I think it becomes a thing that people say in a knee-jerk way, like, she sacrificed so much for her duty to the nation. Like, people said that in the wake of her death so much. People will be saying about that her for forever. I think what this season does an incredible job of is laying bare what that really means. She, you know, she, in order to be the great, you know, head of state, she really did kind of leave her kids, you know, they didn't get as much attention from her as they would have in any other situation. And you have your episode where all three of the kids, Andrew's with that just like horrible wig, the horrible haircut is so good.
Those bangs.
You know, all three of the kids come and talk about not only that their marriages are failing, but that they are like deeply weird and unhappy people. And sacrificing the yacht to stay in the good graces of the people, sacrificing her children's sort of mental happiness. You know, I think then losing everything that her family has built, or a lot of it, in a fire, then just, these are her lowlights, but I think that these are the sacrifices. And I think it was a really good idea to play the moment where she gives this speech and the Queen Mother afterwards is like, why did you do that? Like, you're the Queen, you don't have to apologize. But the Queen is like, no, I do.
It has been, by some margin, the worst year of my reign. Quite possibly my life. I'm happy for people to know.
Know what? Their Queen is depressed.
That I am made of flesh and blood. And that perhaps we have fallen short in our duty as a family. And owe them an apology.
I don't want to also sacrifice my ability to just have human emotion.
Right. No, I felt like that was a really redeeming sequence. And to bookend the episode with those scenes, I thought was a nice, nice touch.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
So, to talk about all of the real-world significance of this, I talked to Dynasty co-host Katie Nichol, who is also Vanity Fair's royal reporter. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, I just really want to know, you know, on the other side of the pond, among the royals and reporters and the royal watchers, how are people feeling about the return of the crown so soon after the Queen's death?
Well, that's really interesting that you ask, Erin, because I was at a lunch yesterday with some former courtiers, and one said they absolutely wouldn't be watching and they were not going to tune in. And the other one said it was just it was too tempting, and there's been just so much hype. They won't be able to help themselves but tune in and watch it. And I suspect that given all of the hype and the PR that this series has had, you know, even before it's actually aired, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was probably the most popular, most watched series. But it's going to feel very, very different to the others because obviously it's covering a much more recent, controversial and explosive period of royal history that many, many people are so familiar with. So I think there is an interest in people wanting to see it and to interpret it in their own way. And I often think when something has had as much press, negative or positive, as this series has had, people actually want to watch it to make up their own minds.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think about the idea that it's, you know, perhaps unfair for Netflix to not emphasize more strongly that it's fictional?
Well, I've said for a while that I think it really should carry a disclaimer. And, you know, I think that is a feeling that is quite common over here, particularly in Britain. I think it was great that they put the disclaimer on the trailer, but I think probably people would like to see it on the whole series. I mean, many programs carry a disclaimer. It doesn't discredit the program in any way. It doesn't detract from the content in any way. And I think it would just serve as a reminder to people that you're not watching a history lesson. And I think that's the danger in all of this, that because the cinematography is so brilliant and the casting is so incredible, you know, even for me as a seasoned royal correspondent, someone that's done this job for many, many years, when I sort of sit back and watch it, not to review it with you guys and to sort of talk about it in a professional capacity, but actually to just sit back and enjoy it, even I have to remind myself that we're watching fiction because it's just done so brilliantly. But I think people have to remember they're watching someone's interpretation of those events.
So I think one thing that you've reported in the past is that Queen Camilla is the royal who actually watches the show. And it seems, you know, that she kind of even understands a little bit that it is somebody's interpretation. There is that recent report that when she met Dominic West, she jokingly called him Your Majesty. So she's not really bothered by it, but do you think the rest of the royals are as relaxed?
Well, I think Camilla is more relaxed than the other royals in many, many ways. I mean, I think she takes the crown as we should all take it, which is with a pinch of salt and as entertainment and not much more than that. I think it says so much about her as a person that she can, you know, watch the actress who conveyed her in the last series and then happily chat to her as she did when I was there at Clarence House at a charity engagement. You know, she understands that these are actors, they are doing a job. She's not taking it too seriously. I know from a friend of hers that, you know, she actually really enjoyed watching the last series and sort of watched it with a large glass of red wine. And I think good for her. Charles has seen some of The Crown. I think the last episode, I think the last series, he watched some of it, but not all of it, feeling that it was getting a little too close to the bone. And so I would be very surprised if the king watches this series. I'd be surprised if any of the family members watch it. I suspect if anyone is to watch it, it'll probably be Camilla because I think she's got an interest. She's got a sense of humor about the whole thing and she doesn't take it too seriously.
So I know one really tough part of this, especially I think is, you know, as much as it is hard to be portraying the queen so close after her death, I think Charles's portrayal so close to him ascending the throne is also a source of controversy. So I know that Sir John Major came out and kind of said point blank, like, that Charles didn't try to get his mom to abdicate. And that was really controversial. Like, what do you think is sort of behind that push that are more people are kind of saying, like, no, that didn't happen? And What is there anything else that you see causing controversy on that side?
Well, I think there are a couple of plot lines that are potentially problematic, controversial, and, you know, do have the potential to sort of backfire on the royal family, or at least put them in the limelight for the wrong reasons. I think the story, Erin, that you just pointed out about this alleged sort of plan for Major, who was the Prime Minister at the time, and Charles, then the Prince of Wales, to oust the Queen, I mean, is ludicrous. It didn't happen. I can completely understand why he would go on the record to actually set the record straight and to say, well, actually, this didn't happen, because the point is the royals can't really do that. Another plot line that I'm sure is going to attract even more headlines is the friendship between Penny Romsey and the late Duke of Edinburgh. And, you know, the clear suggestion in the later series of The Crown is that there was more than a platonic relationship between Philip. And that's pushing a theme, I think, that sort of began in some of the earlier series of The Crown, sort of very much playing into that stereotype of Philip as a womanizer, those suggestions of adultery that are conveyed through the storylines. You know, that's, I think a lot of people feel that's quite disrespectful to Philip's memory. Of course, he's not here to defend himself. It's not something that they would ever speak out about anyway. But I can see that as being another sort of potentially controversial plot line.
That brings up, I think, one piece of controversy about the show in general, which is, you know, Peter Morgan has said that this is a love letter to the Queen. And when they're filming series 6, they even paused it out of respect for her after her death. Does it feel fair to you to say that this is a love letter to her?
I don't think it is a love letter. I think that's, I don't. I think it's certainly a nod to the endless fascination into the monarchy. I mean, don't get me wrong, it is beautifully shot, it's brilliantly done, it's a fantastic piece of drama, but it is drama. You know, I think the problem is for The Crown and for Peter Morgan is that the early series clearly, you know, are about a period of time that very few people remember. There was a nostalgia about it, and as we've got closer to the present, it has, I think, felt more uncomfortable to watch. I think they've sort of pushed it as far as they can. But a love letter to the Queen, I think not.
I think in portraying Princess Diana this time around, we're getting close to the things that Prince Harry and Prince William have said are super, super sensitive subjects for them still. Super painful. I think that when later in the season we get to a recreation of Martin Bashir forging documents and that whole panorama interview, you know, it's almost like refilmed in the show. Is there anything else you're aware of from this period that is just like painful for and unwelcome for the royals to revisit at all? Like no way of doing it would do anything but causing them pain.
Well, I mean, I think the Bashir is a good example of something in the current series that potentially will be quite distressing and upsetting to William and Harry. I mean, William, you'll remember after the BBC did a quite extensive investigation into Bashir and found that he had, you know, been duplicit in getting that interview and all the sort of murky means he used to lure Diana into talking to him. You know, William made it very clear that because of what had been discovered in that investigation, that this interview should never be screened in full again. And in fact, the BBC have given their word that it won't. So the idea that it's being reenacted, it's being reinterpreted and by the Crown, I mean, certainly if the royals aren't watching, I would imagine the royal lawyers will be watching that episode particularly closely. But I think it does churn up a whole load of upset. This covers probably the most painful period in recent royal history. And of course, you know, the actual crash itself in Paris is covered. Watching that is going to be very upsetting. I mean, not that the princes will watch it, but I would imagine it would be incredibly upsetting for them. You know, now we know that the cast of the production were offered counselling after having to film those scenes. Well, I think that gives you every indication that this was highly sensitive, a highly emotional sequence to film. It'll be a highly emotional sequence for many people to watch it as well.
Is there anything else, Katie, that you feel like people that did help people, you know, maybe even in the US, have a bit of a sense of what this really means to British people, especially so soon after the beginning of the new reign?
Timing is everything. And, you know, we know that they suspended filming in respect of the Queen's death. But for this to be going out just weeks into King Charles III's reign is, you know, inconvenient, I suppose, is a bit of an understatement. I think it is very uncomfortable for Charles. It's uncomfortable for the royal family at a time when he's really trying to sort of put the spotlight on the positive start to the reign, the work that he's doing, the sort of markers that he's putting very firmly in place to signal to us what his reign is going to look like. It does just feel a little unfair that the start of his reign is being overshadowed by these controversial issues, whether it's, you know, Harry's autobiography or this series. And I think the few I sat down with someone from the palace not so long ago and asked them about it, and they were very clear. You know, this is drama. We're not getting involved in a crown wrangle. You know, this is a drama, and people will hopefully take it and interpret it as a drama. And I think that's the message, really. I'll be watching it. Many people will be watching it. I suspect this is probably going to be the most popular series yet. But, you know, whilst devouring it for the brilliant production that it is, just remember that, you know, these conversations are someone's impressions and interpretations of what was said around those family dinner tables, because actually no one really knows. And just to remember that it's dramatic, but it is drama with a capital D. Let's not forget that.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie. Julie, there is so much more to talk about with the season of The Crown, including the entire back half of the season, which we have not gotten into yet. So what are some of the highlights for you from those other five episodes?
It was really interesting to see William as a teenager, I thought. And it bears noting that William is played in those teenage scenes by Dominic West's actual son, Sinan West. And you see a little bit him, you know, coming into this realization about what his future is going to hold. And you see how much he's affected by this war, this full-out war between his parents. And you also see him when he's at Eton and living in Windsor, getting to have these weekly teas with his grandmother. And we finally see the Queen in this grandmother role that we haven't seen her that much in before. So that was interesting to me, especially knowing that season 6 gets into the Kate Middleton of it. Mm-hmm. What did you think about those episodes?
Well, I think for one, especially the way that Harry is not a part of it at all, but also that William is the one who, you know, for the Queen, being a grandmother is also, she's teaching him about, you know, the British Constitution. So it's like she shows her love through giving him access to the tools that are going to be his job in the future. And you can tell how, you know, Harry doesn't ever get to have those. So I feel like, you know, they're setting that up really well for the future. To me, the highlight of the back half of the season is the relationship with Hasnat Khan. You get to see Diana have the kind of like adult flirtation, you know, kind of joking, seductive relationship that she never got to have. And I think the whole season does music so well, but there's like a moment where they're sitting in her Kensington Palace apartment listening to Edwin Collins' A Girl Like You. And it's just so like, I don't think that that's actually a song Diana would have listened to, but it's like so perfect. Like, she's in a 1990s British rom-com. She's in her rom-com. Like, amazing. She gets that. And of course it ends sadly, but I just love that so much.
Right. It was nice because it's such a hard season for Diana, for her to have that little moment of light and hope meeting mm-hmm. him. I wasn't sure that we were going to get that relationship on screen, but I'm glad we did. I found it interesting that I don't know if you found it interesting, they don't really get into Diana's affairs at all. Maybe there was an early reference to them, but there's so much focus on Charles's affairs mm-hmm. when when Diana had her own. Did you notice that?
Yeah, yeah. I think that wasn't, I think in the last season they did dealt with it a little with James Hewitt, but I think, but yeah, it's just never, I mean, I think partially it's because, you know, she had them, but not with the one person who he would wind up marrying.
Right, that's marrying, true. That's true. And there were so many other plots to get to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that I'm really glad that they ended, you know, that we know already it's come out that her death is going to be really the season six, which is going to be the final season. It's the only one left. And there is a sense, I think, especially with Imelda Staunton as the queen, you know, coming, thinking about her success as a mother, thinking about her success as a sister, thinking, or, you know, or lack thereof, thinking about her success as a spouse, thinking about her success as a head of state when she's talking to Boris Yeltsin. I think that there is a sense in which you really do feel it start to wrap up because, and it has to, because the woman at the center is no longer the queen.
It was surprising to me that the episode went so far up, so close to Diana's final days. It sort of ends her storyline. This is a spoiler alert, but seeing Fayed and Mohammed Fayed, and she was supposed to go out on holiday with the boys, but she didn't have a place to go. So he offers her a yacht, and we know that what's to come is that she will take those kids on that yacht, and from that vacation, you know, there will bloom this sort of romance between Mohammed's son, Dodi, and Diana. But I was surprised it took us so close. Did you expect that?
Well, I think that I think it's episode three where, you know, we like literally like begin with the birth of Dodi. That I was like, okay, I feel like we're setting up that he is going to be like a side character of this season, but an important one. And which he turns out to be. And I really liked getting that little glimpse of him before they met. I'm glad that they didn't just kind of like drop him in at that point. But it's funny to think about that from a storytelling perspective, because it's just like, wow, they're really like, that is the ultimate cliffhanger, except for that we all know what's going to happen. So I think it's like surprising, but really effective.
Right. And I think if you want some more reading after the season, it's fascinating to read about Mohammed Fayed. And there's just so much, I guess, that they really couldn't get into in the season, but he was obsessed with security. And, you know, according to Tom Bauer, who wrote the unauthorized biography, he had all of these like bugging devices and security devices. And, you know, when Dodi would end up going off with Diana, he had essentially hourly updates as to where they were and what they were doing. And he was just completely masterminding that whole situation, which I'm sure we'll get into very early on in that new season.
So, you know, leaving on a cliffhanger, just like season five of The Crown, I think that does it for this special episode of Still Watching. Richard Lawson and Chris Murphy will be back on Sunday to talk about episode three of The White Lotus, but you can find so much more coverage of The Crown on VanityFair.com, a lot of it written by Julie Miller. Julie, any highlights?
I spoke to a few royal biographers about some of the real life storylines that I was just curious how much, you know, they actually matched up to the episode. So I dig into a little bit the Duke of Windsor's beloved valet. I really appreciated that storyline. I get into Philip and Penelope. We get into the yacht, Britannia. We get into Mohammed and Dodi's very, very complicated relationship. But there is much, much more. And I'll also be speaking to Andrew Morton at length about his thoughts on the season and what he thought of his characterization on the show.
Oh, my goodness. I cannot wait to hear about that. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Ridge. We had technical assistance from Scott Lee. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. Thank you for listening, and God save the king.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie, Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with the romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.